Today is June 10th, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing Lynn Vidali-Gauci over the phone today about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Lynn, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born in San Francisco, California, May 26, 1952.
And did you grow up in San Francisco?
Yes, I was born and raised in San Francisco, and I left my home at the age of 15 to train with Santa Clara Swim Club to train for the Olympic team. I swam in San Francisco until I was 15, and then I moved down with seven-time Olympic coach George Haynes to be my coach.
Tell me a little bit about your family background and what led them to support your swimming.
My grandfather came over in Italy in about 1900s, I don't know. And my dad and my mom, I was an only child for 7 years. My mom had all of us like 7 years apart, so we were like between, I was the oldest and my brother ended up being 7 years younger than I am. So when I learned to swim at the age of five from Charlie Sava, who was Ann Curtis's coach and stuff, I had a ton of energy. I never stopped running. So they put me into swimming, and I went to swimming and I raced, and then I went to synchronized swimming for a while, but that wasn't really what I like to do. I like to race. So I went back to competitive swimming. And then at the age of 14, I broke a world record. Donald Devereaux was 200 IM world record, who was my mentor, who was my idol, who I just, that's, she, when I watched her swim in the Olympic Games. Yeah, and then at the age of 14, I broke a world record, and at the age of 15, I didn't have a lot of competition in San Francisco, so that's why they supported me in my decision to go down and swim at Santa Clara. Santa Clara Swim Club in 1968 Olympics, I think, would have placed third in the, according to the countries. Santa Clara Swim Club had so many kids on the Olympic team that we would have placed third as a country.
Who were a few of your teammates from Santa Clara?
Claudia Cole, Pokey Watson, who was my roommate, James Swaggerty, Jan Henney, there's a ton of them. Mark Spitz, Mitch Ivey, Ray Rivero, who was from San Francisco with me, was an alternate on the Olympic team. We had a lot of swimmers on that Olympic team.
Hmm. Lynn, where did your drive to succeed and your motivation to excel come from? You mentioned breaking a world record at 14. Where did that drive come from?
I wanted to be the fastest in the world.
And why did you want to be the fastest in the world? What made you want to be that?
I don't know. It's kind of like born with it, I think. I'm still dealing with it. It's still part of my personality. It's still who I think there's some things you're born with, and I think there's some things that are hereditary, but I think there's some things that are just make up who you are. And I just had a drive to train. I mean, I think I had a lot of energy, and I think it was where I was successful, and that's where I was getting a lot of my positive reinforcement back in my self-esteem. So I really dove into it. It was really what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel like your training and competition schedule got in the way of life, you know, other things that 14 and 15 year olds were doing?
Nope. I became a teenager at the age of about 24.
Okay.
I retired a couple times. In between, I retired. I didn't keep swimming. In 1968, after the Olympic Games, I think I swam one more year. Then I took off a year and a half and trained 6 months for the next Olympic Games.
Okay.
And made the team.
Wow. Can you describe the Olympic trials, the process, and any problems or challenges?
Well, my first Olympic trials, we're talking about 68, mm-hmm. I made the 400 IM, and I was like, Jan Henney, my teammate, touched me out for swimming the 200 IM by 0.1 seconds. She was probably 18 years old. I was 16. So I made it one event. the next Olympic Games, I made it in three events. But, you know, I was really young. I was really, really young. And the Olympic trials was great. But I remember packing my clothes to go, and my mom would say, "Why are you bringing so much stuff?" And I said, "Well, because I have to go on to the Olympic team." She didn't want to say, "Well, what if you don't make it?" I mean, there was no doubt in my mind that I was not going to make that Olympic team, and I had to go on a training camp for the high altitude. So we went straight from there. We got our uniforms and we went straight to Colorado and trained for a month at the Air Force Academy.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to pack a lot because I was going to be gone for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if I would have done if I did. It would have been a real shock if I didn't make the Olympic team. I'd have all this clothes and I'd have to go back home.
Lynn, how did your friends and family and just, you know, people that knew you and your family, how did they react to learning that you'd made the Olympic team in 68?
They were pretty excited. It did a lot for my family. It was a team effort by my family. You know, my dad only worked for the phone company. My mom was just a stay-at-home mom. You know, I think my dad at the time made $12,000, and they had to pay $250 a month just to have me stay with other families, and then driving back and forth and whatever else was involved. It was a hardship because I went up to my dad and I said, "You know, Dad, I wonder if I don't make this Olympic team, and you're gonna." I never saw my dad. He worked time and a half, and as many over hours as he could. And he said, "Well, we won't know unless we try, will we?"
So it sounds like you had a lot of support from your parents.
Yeah, I had an amazing family.
Mm-hmm. Were any of your siblings athletes as well, or did your...
My brother was a pole vaulter. My brother and sister. My sister really didn't do... My brother played basketball and he did pole vaulting, but my sister did the Alcatraz swim. They're all pretty athletic, mm-hmm. but I was the one who went crazy. I think when the oldest one does that much, you know, kind of, and then we were 7 years apart.
Mm.
You know, I was 14 when my sister was born. I was just starting my heavy training, and my mom was driving up and down the coast of California, 8 months pregnant, trying to be with me and, you know, and my brother and my sister.
Hmm.
So it was hard. She had a newborn right at the time I was going to the Olympic Games.
Oh, wow. So you mentioned high-altitude training in Colorado Springs. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and if you noticed the effects of the altitude at first when you first started training there?
I don't know. I don't... now that when I go into the altitude, since I'm older, I do can feel it, but... I was in such good shape. I didn't think it made too much difference as far. But I think Mexico City, Colorado is very, at the time, it seemed to be very clean air, you know, very, you know, the air was so clean. See, in Mexico City, the air wasn't clean. I think that even though it was an indoor pool, it was, it just was different.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it was different. But I didn't really... I don't think if anybody would have said I was going to altitude, I would have noticed the difference. I think it was, I don't know. I think it was my best time ever. I can't remember if it was or it wasn't. But the training was in Colorado. It was fun.
Anything in your mind stand out about that time with your teammates in Colorado?
Yeah, we were the first women allowed to eat on the dining floor ever with the... what was it? The academy?
Mm-hmm.
Where the men ate on the floor. No women had ever set foot on that floor. And they allowed us to eat dinner with them, and I was in charge of a table. I remember I was 16 years old, in charge of this table. And there were dualies, which were the young ones, and the older ones could tell the dualies to get, you know, lick their plate or do whatever they did. And I said, since I was in charge of my table, I said, "We're just going to eat dinner. We're not going to have any of those..." terrible things go on.
That's really interesting.
Good.
So after high altitude training, I guess you went down to Mexico with the team then.
Mm-hmm. I went to Mexico and when I was 15, the year before they had the little Olympics. So I had a a little bit of experience in Mexico City. But, yeah, we went out the Olympic team to Mexico, and then we were in the, I don't think our dorm was completed properly. We had no, the running water was very poor. It worked sometimes, and it worked sometimes, and then other times it didn't. I got stuck in the elevator in the Olympic Village with my mother. It stopped right. And I'm kind of claustrophobic. I walked out there with my suit. I had my clothes on and my suit underneath, and I walked out there because I was pulling off my clothes because I was so claustrophobic. But I lived through that. We shaved down because we shave our bodies, and then we had to shave down with no water and had razor burns all over our body.
Oh, gosh. It sounds terrible. What was the food like?
I don't remember the food being bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was okay. It was good. I was kind of in a daze. I was only 16. I was just, like, sucking it all in and meeting people. And I met John Carlos there mm-hmm. at the discotheque. And I made friendship with Donnie. I mean, I was from San Francisco. And I got to be very good friends with John Carlos. And then in 72, when I went back in 72, he was representative for Puma. So I was there. And I stayed close. And he went to San Jose State, and I went to San Jose State. So we continued the friendship throughout.
Very cool. Well, did you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts, before you went down to the games?
I knew the students were revolting mm-hmm. In the colleges, and I could hear the gunshots in the distance of the Olympic Village. But I came from San Francisco, so I don't think I was city life, but there was gunshots, and they were killing the students, and they were shooting them down, and, I was like, and then after I swam, and I was done, I wasn't allowed to leave the Olympic Village, but I did. I went on a taxi to go see my parents, and I couldn't find my parents. It took a long time, and my mom was really scared that the taxi driver took me in. Did something with my body, but I ended up getting to my mom and dad. I stayed with them or something that night. Or maybe I had to go back because I wasn't supposed to leave the Olympic Village, but I had a real letdown after my race. You know, I mean, after everything built up to that, I didn't even realize it. I just started crying, couldn't stop crying because I was pretty young. At that time, that was pretty young.
Yeah. So what are your memories of the opening ceremony? Does anything stick out in your mind from the opening ceremony in 68?
Yeah, having to go under the jacket of the guy in front of me because when I let the doves out, they go to the bathroom all over the place. I just thought it was amazing. I mean, it was amazing. I don't remember the opening ceremonies. I didn't go to the closing. I never went to the closing of either games. I don't know why, but I never did. Now that I'm older, I wish I did. But, when you're young, you're just kind of like, I don't want to go to that. So I don't know why. But the opening ceremonies, they were incredible. It was incredible. Mm. Because I watched it on TV when I was 12. When I was 12 is when I decided I was going to make the next Olympic team. And I told my mother I'm going to the next Olympic Games. And she said, oh, okay, that's what I'm going to say. I just remember, it was overwhelming. Lots of people, and I remember it being what I used to watch on TV, and now I was one of them. So I was just really proud.
Mm. Well, you mentioned a friendship with John Carlos, and you mentioned your teammates and roommates. Was there anyone on the team with whom you were particularly close?
Yeah, Pokey. Pokey Watson mm. was my roommate all through training camp. And she's still my best friend.
Oh, that's awesome.
She lives in Hollywood. She was on the 68 team. She was on the 64 team. She won a gold medal when she was 13.
Oh, my gosh. Gold medal. That's incredible. That's mm-hmm. that's really young. So what about interactions with other national teams? For example, did you have any memorable interactions with any athletes from the Soviet bloc or from East Germany?
I remember being on buses I remember being on buses, and then they would have on their jacket USSR or whatever their jackets said that they were Russian or whatever. And, you know, growing up, you know, you hear stuff about the Russians and, you know, it, just from the adults in your family and your house and stuff. And you know, my whole perception of it was, God, the kids are so nice. Everybody was so nice. We traded. I remember loving the Swedish suits because they were blue and gold, and we traded American suits for Swedish suits. And I just remember, I said, it must be, and I was a young kid, I said, it must be the big boys that don't get along, because the people, the athletes and everything, were also very nice and very quiet. And I noticed that I didn't want to be really loud, because the Americans can be very loud, and the Europeans tend to be a lot more quiet.
So your competition, you mentioned feeling let down afterwards. Can you explain a little bit about that and about winning your silver medal in the 400 IM?
Yeah, Claudia Cove won it. She was my best friend and my teammate at Santa Clara. I was supposed to take third or fourth, but I ended up taking second. I remember the awards ceremony. My family, my mom and dad were there, and my brother, my little brother. So I remember being really proud, and I remember the awards ceremony was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was crying. I've never seen my dad cry ever in his life.
That must have been a really proud moment for him to watch you get that medal.
Yeah, and he sat next to Johnny Weissmuller.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I met Johnny Weissmuller's son. He lives in San Francisco, because I've done some Olympic functions and stuff. And he sat next to Johnny Weissmuller and got his autograph. God knows where it is. I just know who Johnny Weissmuller was, and I know I used to watch the stuff, but that was young. He had to be in his 60s then, sitting next to my father. I don't know. I can't remember. I don't know. I don't have a real idea of time, you know.
Yeah. So what did you do immediately after your event and your medal ceremony?
I don't know. I just waited for the games to be over. I ended up leaving and going and staying with my parents for a night, I think. But I don't remember too much about that, actually. I know, funny, it's weird. But yeah, I just live in the Olympic Village because there are still events going on and stuff. So I was done swimming.
Mm-hmm.
I went home.
Testing for banned and performance enhancing substances. The 68 Summer Games were probably the first Summer Games where there was like a drug testing program implemented.
I don't remember being drug tested at all.
Mm-hmm.
I remember having my hair pulled out to see if I had the right amount of chromosomes, that if I was really a girl.
Oh, what was that like?
I don't know. They pick strands of your hair and they test it, and I passed. I have this certificate. Was that 72? I can't remember. Was that 68? It had to be 68.
They also did that in 68. So what did you think about that or feel about that at the time?
Just thought that we all needed to be on the same playing field. And so, see, I was in the Olympic Games in 72, and the girl that touched me out was Cornelia Ender, and she was one of the biggest steroid abuse users. End up 70 by 76, she was full-fledged, and she ended up marrying Roy Mathis, and their kids had birth defects. You know, so later in life, it affected my swimming in the Olympic Games, because Cornelia Ender and all those East German girls were, and they didn't know it. They were being drugged by their coaches and stuff. They were taking pills, and they said they were vitamins and whatever. But in 68 was just the very beginning of all that, and I don't remember. I remember more on them trying to establish whether you were completely a female, or if you had too much testosterone, or whatever they were trying to figure out. That to me was the thing that stood out the most. Not so much drug. Well, you had. I don't remember too much drugging stuff. I just remember if they wanted to make sure that you were a girl and that you weren't that you were competing with women and you were a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And not a man.
Yeah.
But I don't remember any drug testing or doing urine or anything like that.
Okay. Did you happen to witness Tommy Smith's and John Carlos' protest, or were you around the Olympic Village when the protest took place?
God, I don't even remember. I just remember that there was a lot of commotion about it.
Mm-hmm.
In the Olympic Village, and I know that they took him out of the Olympic Village. That's all I knew.
Mm-hmm. So you did experience some of the reaction, I guess, the blowback that happened afterward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were taken out, and then they were, I don't know. I know a lot about the story now because I know Johnny, and I read his book.
Mm.
And, I knew about the Australian on the horse stand and all different stuff about it now. But, you know, I was the type of swimmer and athlete. I would never read the newspaper because I couldn't stand to listen to the media put down athletes or pin one athlete against another or make myself, you know, if they write something about me and they would say that they thought that so-and-so was going to beat me. I never wanted to read any of that. So I didn't read any of it. I just swam and I worked out and I trained and I competed.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to become a professional athlete. I just wanted to be the fastest in the world and I wanted a gold medal. All the other crap that went on, I didn't want any part of.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. So you mentioned the media. Did you have any interactions with the media at the 68 games?
Oh, God, I don't remember. I remember Jim McKay was a really nice man. He used to do my interviews and stuff, yeah. I mean, and my mom would tell me, now be really nice and smile. Do I have to? No, I did. Yeah, I remember, yeah, I did interviews. I did them fine, you know. I was pretty young. Claudia, you know, they would interview Claudia and I together. I remember doing an interview. I remember being in the press box at the end with my coach and Claudia on one side and me on the other. I even have a picture of that. And that was wonderful. It was great to be, you know, with my coach and one of my best friends took the gold and I took the silver.
Yeah.
And we were both with Santa Clara Swim Club. So that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, definitely. Did any friends or family back home get to see your event? Was it covered?
Oh, they all did. They, in fact, they took a movie. At the time, they didn't have, you know, they only had Super 8. So my cousin or my uncle took a movie of the TV.
That's
yeah,
really cool.
I have my race in 72 from Wide World Sports, but I don't have any footage of, the only footage I have is of the TV being filmed in 68.
Well, that's pretty neat footage.
Yeah, kind of blurry, but it's okay.
Yeah, huh. Well, are there any other memorable or interesting experiences from the 68 games that are personally meaningful to you that you would like to share?
Oh, I can't think of any. I made the goal when I was 12. And I made it when I was 14, when I was 16. Everything that I wanted to do, and I said I was going to do, I did. I never did end up getting a gold. I got touched out in 72, and I was ahead and qualified first. I ended up with a bronze. But I don't know. It was everything I ever wanted, and it was an experience of a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then I was in Germany when everybody was shot and killed. So In both Olympic Games that I've gone to, I never wanted to stay around. Like a lot of times, like after 72, I was invited to go to Greece and swim. I wanted to come home. With all the gun shooting and everything, you know, I was hiding under a hammock in 72 when they said they thought there was another sniper attack and they were in the village and all the athletes got killed. You know, the Olympic Games after that started to be a little bit more safe, but they used to be a political venue for politics. And I really wanted no part of that. It was a place where people go and train and try to be the best in the world, the way it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much political stuff in the two Olympic Games that I went to that it kind of ruined it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, here I am trying to become the fastest in the world, and I'm off at a distance. I can hear they're shooting students. You know, the students are revolting, and they're killing him in the streets. And I can hear the gunshots. At the time, being so young, it was a world that I never knew. Mm-hmm. I didn't come from that kind of a world. And even though the world did exist like that, it wasn't a part of my world.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought when I went to the Olympic Games that it'd be a safe venue, that it'd be a very safe environment, because after all, we're just doing sport. But that never was the case in either Olympic Games that I went to.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of the security measures at the 68 Games and then at the 72 Games?
Well, they were much better than 72. Mm-hmm. I think 68 was much better than 72. I don't know. I think you have to have all those incidences that take place in order to up the security. Because in 72, I had a friend who was on the weightlifting team from San Francisco, and I gave my pass to his wife to get into the Olympic Village, and she was Asian, and she got in.
Hmm.
Yeah. So there was no. I think the security. I don't think they checked. And being the Germans, I couldn't believe it was like that. But no, there wasn't any security, and that's how those guys got in. They acted. They put sweats on and acted like athletes and jumped over the fences and ended up getting into the Israeli dorm, and that's how all that started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then in Mexico, there were no real incidents in the village. There even was, I guess. I don't know if you know this, and I don't remember exactly what race it was, but the relay race for our track athletes, they were given the wrong time at the final.
Oh my gosh!
And I think that was a political move.
Whoa!
And if you could interview Donny Carlos, you could get a great interview.
Yeah.
But they were in the market, the international market. You know, that was the big thing, to go shopping at the international market and buy the blankets and all the Mexican stuff. And they looked up at the TV and the race was going off and they weren't there.
My gosh.
I sat on the plane home with those guys and it was a very quiet plane. See, you only have one chance to go to the Olympic Games sometimes. And at that day and age, that's the way it was, because people had to train, go to the Olympic Games, and then we had to go to work and get a real job. See, now athletes, their career has become their real job.
Yeah, how do
you... Because they get paid, and there's endorsements, and there's trust, and there's, you know, I think the Olympic Games, when I swam, the officials were treated... The officials and the big boys and all those guys... They stayed in suites, and we weren't treated anything. I mean, now the athletes are treated, you know, with incredibly, because they are like the gods in the whole venue. You know, they're treated with the best.
Mm-hmm.
And Olympic Games, I was the part of the era. I was the time that things started to change, 68, 72, and 76. That's when the change started to take place. That's when the security got tighter. Because after all, you've had, you know, the slaughter in 72, and then there was something else, with a bombing that was somewhere around that time. So they really upped the security and really changed a lot of stuff of the venues.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care where I was in life. Everybody learned from where I had been.
Right.
It was school, the Olympic Games, or whatever it was. It seemed like, it was always after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you do right after the 68 Games when you returned home? Did you take a break, or did you return immediately to training to prepare for the 72
Games?
Probably
took a break. I took a break. Mayor Eliotto had a parade. I had a cousin who was a politician, so they had a parade down Market Street, an open car parade, and, I was a celebrity of San Francisco because I was the only girl that ever went to the Olympic Games or whatever. So I took some time off and rested, and then I went back and I trained for another year. But it's hard staying up on that level. Once you're the top of the world, it's very hard. So after, the pressure was pretty good, and I did a couple nationals, indoor nationals, and I won, and I was, Claudia retired, I was number one then, and I was world swimmer of the year, and then I took some time off, and I didn't think I'd ever go back. But about 8 months before the next Olympic Games, I started training again. So I think I trained in 68. I went back and swam all the way through August of 69. And then I didn't go back in the water. My mom let me stay in Santa Clara and graduate from there because I kept going. Every time I came back or training, I'd go back to Mercy High School in San Francisco. Then I'd go back to Santa Clara High School. And since I didn't really have a normal life, I was a teenager, I asked if I could stay in Santa Clara and graduate with all my friends as a senior. And so I took the year off and I was a teenager. I was on my own. I was really on my own at 18, 17 and 18.
Mm-hmm.
Had my own apartment, and I went to high school, and I graduated from high school. I think I lived with some good friends for a while. I lived with like five or six different families when I first moved there.
Hmm.
Like a train. I got mononucleosis living with one family. She didn't feed me enough, and I didn't want to complain because I didn't want my mom to pull me out of there.
Hmm.
But I didn't eat enough, and I got really sick. That was right before the 68 Games. I got mononucleosis really bad December before.
Oh, gosh. That must have had a
She didn't feed me enough, and I didn't want to complain because I didn't know if I had no. You know, as a kid, if I was this age, I would have complained and my mom would have got me another place to stay or something would have worked out. But I didn't complain. I just kept my mouth shut, and I was always hungry, and they didn't have any fast food then. I used to ride my bike and go eat chocolate, or I'd go down to the bakery because I was really hungry all the time.
Mm.
Yeah, but I got really worn out, and I got mono. Because I was training so hard.
Yeah. Well, what can you tell me about 72, you know, the highlights or, you know, the big things that stand out on your mind about 72 and also the major comparisons that you can make between your experiences in 68 and 72?
Well, I was a little bit more, I was 20, I was more grown up. But still had the same attitude where I wanted to be the fastest in the world. I trained hard. I didn't take any steroids or anything like that. And there was nothing but steroids. The suits that these Germans come in with the Lycra suits on, we still had the flaps. They had the tight swimming caps and the goggles on top. You know, us, the U.S. swimmers, were still a little bit behind that. We didn't have all that. The girl who beat me, touched me out, ended up being one of the worst steroid abusers there were in 76. Games had changed a lot. There were drugs and enhancement, and the Olympic Committee couldn't keep up with them. They couldn't keep up with all that stuff because it was new. They didn't have the technology to trace it all. But I never really focused on that because, she only touched me out by two-tenths of a second, but I did go out way too hard. I qualified first. I was number one in the world, and I didn't get the gold medal, you know, bronze. But the games were much more sophisticated. I had my own apartment. The living quarters were amazing. You know, it was a lot cleaner and a lot nicer. You know, Germany could play to Mexico City. I mean, it's just two different worlds.
Yeah.
But I met some really neat people there. I met Steve Prefontaine, who was that runner,
uh-huh,
in 72. I got his whole life story. And then after he died, I watched a movie on him. And he had told me everything. So that was neat. I ran into Kirk Douglas on the bridge of the Olympic Village by himself.
Huh.
So there were really neat. I was walking across the bridge for the disco late at night. I think I was done swimming because it was pretty late. It was like 2 in the morning. I saw this man standing over there under the light, and he has horrible skin, like pockmarked skin. And I know all the old actors because I used to watch all the old movies. So I said, "Excuse me, are you Kirk Douglas?" He turned around. "Yes, honey, I am." I went, oh, I thought that was you. So we ended up sitting up there and talking for a little bit, and he asked me who I was and where I swam. And anyway, so that was kind of cool. And in Germany, at the last night, we pretended, three of us girls pretended to be drunk. We weren't drunk, but we pretended to be drunk, and we put our hoods on, and we got a guy, and we put a hood on him, and we pretend to be drunk and go into our dorms to see if we, because we were trying to see if we could get, this was after everybody died, we wanted to see if the security got any better. It didn't, so we got the guy in, and we couldn't get him out, but we got him in. We got him into our dorms. The guy just let us walk right through.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
It's interesting. So you mentioned amateurism a little bit, the difference between being involved in elite amateur sports in 68 and 72 versus the way it is for elite athletes today. What do you think about that, and what are your just reflections?
The difference between 72 and now, I went to Olympic. I've been to the last two Olympic trials. Mm. The athletes don't even get in contact with the public. It's a whole different venue. It's a whole different. Well, these guys, I mean, there's much more money. See, we're like the old 49ers and the old. I mean, there was not money, much money involved in it. The people who made all the money was the people outside the athletes. You still have your, Michael Phelps. I mean, there's, Ryan Lochte is probably worth about 15 to 20 million right now. We got nothing for our swimming career. In fact, I Magnin, Cyril Magnin, who owned Joseph Magnin's and all those stores back then, probably way, way before your time. He sent me a check for $500 to help me in my swimming career, and I had to take it back because of amateur athleticism. I couldn't take it. My parents really struggled for me, to train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a whole different venue now.
Mm-hmm.
You still have a lot of athletes who don't get money. And, you have your top ones. You got your Missy. You have the endorsements. Amateur. They've changed. I don't even know how they do it now, but they change everything. They put in trust. They do different things to get around. We were always, the United States, even in 68, were competing against professional athletes from other countries. They took care of their athletes. But then there's a side that I don't know if, I wouldn't want to be taken out of my home at the age of 10 and be made an athlete. I mean, I still had my family. I had my family. I had my Santa Clara family. I had my San Francisco family. I still got to come and go. I had the freedom to come back and forth. I wasn't just taking like the Chinese used to take the gymnastics, and those parents never, their kids were like awarded the gymnastics program. That's the way a lot of how it worked in other foreign countries. But I would have kept swimming. In fact, I almost went back and when I was 30 something. I don't know what Olympic Games that was, but I wanted to train again.
Hmm.
And I think I was bigger and stronger, and I really believed in that philosophy. But because, I was a day late and a dollar short, I didn't do it. And I just was getting married and going to have children. I started having children late. I didn't have my first child until I was 35, who turned out to be a professional water polo player for Italy. And my son played All-American water polo player. Hmm. And now they're both coaching swimming.
Oh, wow.
But I don't know. It's a different venue now. There's a lot more. You see kids and athletes competing into their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that couldn't happen before.
Yeah.
Because your parents weren't gonna keep paying for you. I mean, my mom and dad were incredible, but I mean, if I wanted to make another Olympic team, I'm sure they would have done something. But I had two brothers and sisters behind me that also needed some attention.
Right. So did you make a conscious decision to leave swimming at some point, or did it just gradually happen because life?
Well, I left. I used to go back every year to my coach George and say, I'm not going to swim this year, George. And he'd say, yes, you are. And I go, okay, I'll swim. So I swam. I just wanted him to talk me into it. And then I think one year when I was about 23, I said, I don't know. He goes, no, I think it's time you quit. I was like, oh my God, you don't want me anymore? No, and then I went to college. See, I went to college late. By the time I finally went to college, I was like 23. I mean, out of JC. And because like every time I started training, I would quit going to school
because
it was too hard. So, but I graduated from San Jose State. I got one of the first scholarships and I went to school there and I swam there. I never lost a race in college. I was inducted in the Hall of Fame at San Jose State, but I had a scholarship, but I got out of my scholarship the last year because I had to do student teaching. I became a teacher. So I had to do all my student teaching and school was hard for me. It wasn't easy. And I think that's one of the reasons why I swam. Swimming got me through a lot of stuff that I had a hard time getting through myself.
Yeah.
Even when the teachers made it way easier for me because I was training 4 hours a day. So I think it was, it was a good venue for me, but I did get through college and I graduated and I ended up becoming a teacher for 30, 4 years I was a physical education teacher, and I was a coach and athletic director and cheerleader advisor and did everything possible that you could do in a high school. And I just retired, and now I developed a line of sports jewelry, and I'm selling sports jewelry for kids to wear to get and to save both all their years of their sports.
That's wonderful. So you mentioned you got one of the first scholarships. Was this like a Title IX program scholarship, or?
This is when it wasn't NCAAs. It was AI, Intercollegiate Athletic for Women. American, I don't know what the A stood for. It was AIAW. And I got offered some assistance to go to Arizona. But I had been traveling so much and lived away from home so much that I stayed in San Jose. So when San Jose State offered me a scholarship, they paid for my books and tuition, I think. I didn't get room and board, but I got books and tuition.
Hmm.
So I took that.
Then I
coached swimming, and I swam for San Jose State, and I never lost a race.
That's amazing.
And now I'm on the Ordis Barter board with San Jose State. I've gone back after they inducted me into the Hall of Fame. You know, Bill Walsh coached there. We have a lot of good athletes. You know, Johnny Carlos came out of there. We had Speed City out of there, the track team, and it was a very good time for athletes when I went there.
Yeah. So, how are you involved in the sport of swimming today? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I'm kind of retired from it all.
Mm-hmm.
I teach private lessons in my backyard. I start with babies from two on up. I did quit after I retired from school. I coached like 28 years. I coached in high school out of the 34. Maybe it was even more than that. And then after I quit. After I retired from teaching, I coached the city program, the Park and Recs, because I wanted to give back to the kids. That's how I started. So I really wanted to build up our city. I live in Morgan Hill. I wanted to build up that program, and I did. I built it up to 195 swimmers, and then my son came on deck and started coaching with me. So I figured it was time for me to go. He would do a good job, and I don't need to coach anymore. And plus, I got remarried, and I wanted to didn't have my evenings free, so I stopped coaching. But now I'm running all over selling my jewelry.
Yeah.
Working with schools, giving money back to different programs. They can mix them. You know, I give them 15% back. I'm working a lot of swim meets, but I'm no longer coaching.
Uh-huh.
I want to be able to do what I want to do now, and I really love my business, and it's starting to take out and kind of taking over my life now again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's another challenge. You know, you talked about personality. I want to see if I can do it.
Yeah.
I want to see if I can make it. I have no business background. I wrote a business plan, and I'm college licensed for two colleges, San Jose State and San Diego State, because that's where my daughter went. And I can sell jewelry out of those colleges. You know, I just wanted to see if I could do it. But I really like the philosophy about wearing what you are.
Yeah.
And I have a good friend who makes the jewelry that we design and stuff, and it's kind of fun.
Very cool. Well, Lynn, I wanted to ask a kind of a follow-up question about 72 before I forget or we close the interview. So you mentioned that the German women, the German women swimmers in 72. Did you know at that time that there were steroids?
There was a lot of talk about it. And her voice was very, very, when I shook her hand, her voice was very deep. They were very, very cut. They were very, very defined. Body types were much different, and in 76 it was 10 times worse.
Now were you
so there was a lot of talk about it, but I mean I never focused on that stuff because it didn't do me any good.
Right
I mean, what am I gonna do until they prove it? I mean, I can't, you know, I was just like reading the newspapers. I can't be involved with that. I have to worry about what I'm gonna do. I was enough to take care of it, let alone deal with what they were doing.
Right.
Because it's very nerve-wracking being at the Olympic Games. I kept saying to myself, put me in a room before I compete with, and it's really funny, I'm reading a book, Larry the Conductor, it's called Gold. I don't know what made me pick it up in the airport when I traveled down here to Palm Desert. I picked up, it's all about an Olympic athlete about bikers.
Oh.
And it talks about, it's amazing. I see so much of myself. I'm starting to, it's kind of scaring me that I picked up this book and I'm reading it. But it's very nerve wracking. They put me in a room, was it 68? Yeah, no, was it 60? Yeah. Sabina, it was a little Italian girl. I don't know, I was 68. And she was jumping around. And see, I never really talked to much of the other athletes. I mean, I don't go up to another athlete and say, I'm going to kick your ass. I'm not that kind of person. You know, but they do that. Or they get in your face, they try to suck you out, and they jumping all around. I wanted to throw up. I wanted to get out of that room.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and then they let you out of the room, and they got all these little flags. All the Americans are going, you know, and it's just, you just want to die.
Yeah.
Anyway, I said to myself, I'd rather be home having a baby. That was the worst thing that I could be doing. That could be a lot of pain. And then when I was having a baby, I was sitting there going, God, I wish I was swimming in the Olympics.
That's funny. So were you drug tested in 72? Do you remember being drug tested in 72?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did. That was urine.
And what did you think about that?
I did what they told me to do. I didn't think anything of it.
Yeah.
But I know, but it was, you know, that people... You know, anyway, you know, then you know, Pokey, who I'm very close to, the roommate in 68, she ended up marrying Dr. Alan Richardson, who's passed away from cancer, which was a very sad thing at the age of 55. But he was a doping doctor that went back and caught the Chinese.
Oh, really?
Well, that's her husband, yeah. So, you know, and I went to China in 73 with Kissinger set up, and we went and worked with the people. I was done with swimming. They banned us because China was not a part of the FINA, was not a part of the Olympic Games. They were not allowed in. And so we were Olympic athletes going back. I went with Kissinger, and it was a documented tour, met Chairman Mao's wife, and we were Olympians working with the People's Republic of China. Of course, they kicked us off the team, but we didn't kick us off competing in the United States, but we weren't going to compete anymore anyway. We were retired, and then they reinstated us. Like, I cared.
They kicked you off for going to China?
Mm-hmm.
But
Kissinger, because the FINA, the Chinese were not allowed in the Olympic Games at the time.
So who?
Whatever political.
Who kicked you off the team?
The U.S. It was AAU. Was it AAU or USS? It's now USS Swimming.
Okay,
but the FINA governing body said they can no longer compete for our country because we're going back to a country that they don't recognize.
Oh. But you went with as part of a Kissinger, like a State Department program.
It was Friendship Through Sports.
Friendship Through Sports.
In fact, they just had a reunion of all those people in Florida. I didn't go because I had my business. I opened up this new business. I had so many obligations. But there were like 300 Chinese, and I couldn't believe them. One of my friends did go. Karen Mo did go, and she said to me, "These people thought we were gods there. We changed their life, you know, we did whatever." But then when the Chinese were in, when they finally got in the Olympic Games and they were testing, they had so much trouble with drugging.
Hmm.
So they're cleaning up. They're constantly cleaning up the drug testing, and but they have to stay one step ahead of everything because they always change the chemicals, and they have to be able to trace them. And in the olden times, you know, like it's just like when you had sports have changed so much over the last, I want to say 50 years, all sports. You used to have the 49ers, you had the old players, and they made X amount of dollars, you know, but they didn't make that. But now everything is so much money. You know, it kind of, in a way, it ruins it. You know, you had athletes who wanted to win just because they wanted to be the best in the world, not because they wanted to retire and make money and drive a Ferrari.
Yeah, it's a big.
So difference. You know, I think you had. I'm sure you still had garbage going on, but you really had athletes really doing things for all the right reasons. I think it's both. I really think. And then I'm kind of jealous because if I had the chance to work out my whole life and train, not my whole life, as long as I could, and financially support myself, I would have done that because I love swimming.
Mm. It's certainly changed. Lynn, What was for you the most meaningful part of being a participant in the Olympic Games?
What was the most meaningful part? I think the friendships that I made through, I think the journey was incredible. I'd do it all over again. The journey was incredible. The people you meet, the thing, the character building. I mean, everything has its good side and bad side. It made me kind of a tough individual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to pursue your dream and to do it and to get there. I mean, a lot of people say, well, why don't you like your bronze medal? I hate my bronze medal. Because why? Because I was number one in the world and I should have gotten the first place. That was it, you know? Mm-hmm. That was it. You know, and even to this day, people who don't never did it, you don't understand. But, I don't know, being on the award stand, representing my country, having my mom and dad there was probably the highlight of my life. That and giving birth, both things have something to do with giving birth. The two most important things in my life was the Olympic Games and giving birth to my children. And both times I wanted to be back at the other things.
That's funny.
That was probably more of an out than anything else. But, you know, it was just doing my dream.
Yeah.
Breaking the world record, you know, being the top of the nation. I was a national champion many times. I wanted to be number one in the world, only for what my goals were, not for any other reason.
Mm-hmm. So what impact has your involvement in the Olympic movement had on the rest of your life?
I think it had a lot to do with my character building I'm pretty honest in the way I coached, the way I instilled into kids their dream and the right thing to do. And my mom and dad always taught me, and I did my children, is the one thing you don't do is you don't lie and you have to be trustworthy. That's the most important thing in this world, because I don't care how much money you have or what you do, if people can't trust you, you have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I've carried that throughout my whole life in my coaching career and my swimming career and the way I live.
Mm-hmm. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
I think anybody can do it. I think anybody can get there. It just takes a lot of work. I think people who are naturally talented, sometimes it's a lot. I was very naturally talented. I could quit and join and start swimming and make another Olympic team. And that was also a thing that wasn't so good, because I think if you need to work a little bit harder sometimes, you appreciate what you have a little more, that you don't have to, you can't turn it on and off. Just, you know, work hard, train hard, and live by that and do the best you can. You know, it's, nobody knows, in any given day, we all don't know what's going to happen, but don't not go after your dream because you're afraid you're not going to succeed, because I don't think anybody should have any regrets in their life. Whether they make the Olympic team or they don't, the one thing you never want to have is a regret.
Mm-hmm. Very good advice. Lynn, so this project is, you know, focused on the 68 team. What, in your opinion, is the legacy of the 1968 team?
The legacy?
What makes that team so special, or what made it unique in the history of U.S. Olympic teams?
I think it was a real turning point. It was the beginning of a real turning point for the modern day, well, it is the modern day Olympics, but the real modern day Olympics where, you know, it was the time when they started, there was a lot of controversy, there was a lot of political movement, there was a lot of political things brought into a sport which that should not have happened. And I understand Johnny Carlos' thing, and never really was against that in any way, shape, or form. I think our black athletes needed to be recognized. I think on the playing field they were used and treated like crap when they went home. And I think
human rights or humanitarian...
Yeah, for human rights, I think it cleaned up. It made I think the Olympic Games was the 68 Games was a start of cleaning up what needed to be done in the Olympic Games for our athletes to be treated on the same level. It also brought out the beginning of people cheating with drugs and stuff, so it had to be cleaned up. It also realized that I really believe, you know, when I really heard and I learned a lot from Steve Prefontaine, and he was really upset with a lot of the officials, and if you get a chance, get a hold of Johnny Carlos's book, and you'll see his take on it. It's a very small book that you can probably read it in one day.
Okay.
It gave me a whole insight to what was going on that I didn't even really realize and never really looked into the prejudice and what it would take our black athletes out of the ghettos, and basically they'd come, you know, if they could compete and they can compete, and they were great athletes. And then once all that was done and U.S. got their numbers and their golds and their whatever, they went back to the same lifestyle that they had, you know, and it was so poverty stricken and whatever. I don't know. It was part of the growth of, I think the 68 games was a part of when our country was really growing. And I, you know, you really don't grow in anything, even in your own life, you don't grow unless you're in a lot of pain. The only time you really grow, when everything's comfortable, I mean, it used to be very comfortable for those officials and the big boys in the Olympic Games because everybody did what they said they were going to do. Well, in 68 games, you started having people protest. They weren't going to be treated that way anymore. The black athletes didn't want to be treated that way anymore. You know, there was still revolting going on with the college students in the Mexico games, and there was a lot of turmoil in that game and in the 72 games. And then after that, it seemed like it was a whole different kind of, I don't see any turmoil. I see people getting together with sport. Yes, they have to be careful with different things and athletes and security and stuff. But I think the 68 and 72 games was, everything started happening and things started getting cleared up and the athletes got treated better. And, you know, it wasn't just about the big officials and their big high rises and their penthouses and their speaking engagements and whatever, you know, it's now focused on the athletes. The athletes run the athletic world now. I mean, they run it by being, they're the main reason why everybody's there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think starting in 68 and 72, that started to happen.
Makes sense.
It was a time for change. It was the biggest time for change.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And painstaking. And it was painful.
Absolutely.
But yeah, but I don't think things change unless you're in pain. I don't think anybody changes. I think when you're having more, I keep telling my kids, I said, when they're having a hard time and they're 25 and 27, and they are having hard times. You know, I said, now you're going to really grow a lot. Make sure, look at me. You'll go expect sympathy. You're just going to grow a lot right now.
Crisis drives change.
Yeah, so I think when it was a very stressful time in the Olympic Games and for our athletes and for, you know, Johnny Carlos is, first wife committed suicide. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a really sad part of that.
And a lot of it had to do with the way they, and I'm sure a lot of the stuff, and he was a crazy wild man. I mean, it was the 60s too. You got to remember, it was the 60s. It was a lot of things that came into that era. You know, it was a hippie generation. It was the 60s. It was Black Panther. I mean, it was a very, very volatile time in our country, along with the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
But it seemed to make it through it, seemed to help a lot of change. We're educating our, you know, we used to use our, I mean, I went to college in a time where I would go to a kinesiology class, I can't remember what class it was, but I'd go there, and not one football player would be in that room. Although they'd all be in the room, but on test day, there was no football players in the room. And I struggled to get my B's and my C's, and they didn't have to be there for tests, and they got all A's.
Gosh.
You know, and that exists in the sport for a long time. I think that the playing field has gotten cleaned up a lot. I think everybody, they want all these kids to get an education. You know, these poor, for a while there, a lot of these poor black athletes that they would take out of, you know, homes that were, you know, and they would play ball and stuff, and they work, and they're all great, and they're great athletes, and they would make, you know, but they didn't care about their education, because once they get hurt in the big time, they're done, and now I have nothing to fall back on, at least now they're trying to educate our kids and take those kids out of different home environments they were, that they didn't have the chances of some of the other kids, and try to give them make them have an education. And cleaning up the College Act, you know, the NC2As and all the rules and all this stuff. I think all that comes out of that's a change that has taken place, and I think it's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
You still have the same stuff going on in a lot of ways, but there's higher goals, there's higher expectations, there's more rules. When people break rules and there's a lot of hurt and a lot of anger, and then that's when people start changing the thing and not allowing that situation to take place like that anymore.
Mm-hmm. So you think 68 was kind of the turning point when things started to change?
Yeah, I think, I think 64, I don't remember much. Well, I was little then. I was 12. But I don't think, when you start looking back into history, and my husband is a history major, and I'm terrible, so I'm not. But when you start looking back into the history of the Olympic Games, I think in 68 is when the turmoil really started.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 80, when Carter... that was another thing. When Carter wouldn't let us go to the Olympic Games, my coach, they invited the whole 80 team back to the White House for a luncheon, and all these athletes didn't go. You know, it's not his say. He has no right to do that. If you can send who's the black athlete that they sent to Germany, very famous.
In 36?
Yeah.
Or 32?
Jesse Owens. I mean, if you can send Jesse Owens to a country where Hitler is present and they hate anything but the white race, let alone a black man, if you can send him there, you know, you can still have the 80 Olympic Games go on. That's not right. That should be separate from politics.
A lot of people have definitely expressed that view. Well, Lynn, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you would like to tell us about?
Nope.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and thank you so much for being so generous with your time and your memories. I don't want to take up too much more of your time.